So this is part two. So part one was the guy who founded Triratna Buddhist community is a guy who's called Sangharajta, who's an Englishman who was born in the mid-1920s, was a unusual young man. Like, Buddhism didn't exist, barely existed in the UK, but he had this very strong, broadly spiritual kind of intuition about there being meaning in life, and that focused in on Buddhism. He spent from the mid-40s to the mid-60s living in India, like exploring loads of different Buddhist traditions, like being a monk and then getting into Mahayana and Tibetan Buddhism and learning a lot. That's the short version of what I said last week. And so we ended last week in 1964, where by this time Sangharajta the Buddhist scene is tiny, like the global, you know, you've got Southeast Asia, which has got established Buddhism, but the sort of like kind of thoughtful Western kind of academic Buddhist scene is tiny. You know, like you have less than the number of us in this room, people writing books and writing articles about it. So it's a very, very small scene. And Sangharajta's in 1964, he is like 39, and he's been writing for the last kind of 20 years and sort of slowly gaining a name, just as somebody who says interesting and useful things about Buddhism. And particularly what he's doing is he's consistently drawing a broader perspective and saying, okay, well, you've got kind of like Tibetan Buddhism over here and Sri Lankan Buddhism over here and Japanese Buddhism over here. What's the big picture? What have they all got in common? What's the point behind what they're doing? And he's increasingly gaining a name and a reputation for doing that. And so by 1964, he's been ordained as a monk for about, I don't know, like 16, 18 years at this point. And he's the most long-established English-born monk in the Buddhist world, basically.
Not for
that's a massive achievement, because there's barely anyone. So it's like five English monks in the world or something. So it's not like, you know, it's not the first of millions. So anyway, so 1964, the UK Buddhist scene is bigger than it was 20 years ago, but still pretty small. But anyway, he gets a letter saying, "Will you come to England and teach Buddhism to English people? Because we think they'll like it, but it's a bit sleepy." So he comes and he. It's worth saying, this is just before we go on with that. I am telling you a story, yeah. So I'm not only am I going to tell you a story, but I'm going to tell you a fairly compressed story. So the thing about all stories is, of course, is that they are not literally. They never contain the whole truth, because life is always more complex, isn't it? Like, if you imagine just telling, you know, somebody says, "How was your holiday?" And you, even if you told them about what you did every day, that's still a story. You're still choosing the bits to tell. You're editing the experience. So, of course, what I'm going to tell you is an edited story. And it's edited in a number of different ways. The first one, of course, is that when you're reading something backwards, you see the significance of earlier events. So, for example, you know, like, so as I tell you this story, well, obviously we're sitting here in this room, which says that whatever happened in 1964, it was significant. Because if nothing happened, then we wouldn't be here having this conversation. So do you see what I mean? You automatically sort of see the significance of what happens because of the fact that it went somewhere. Yeah, like, what's his name? Steve Jobs. You know, when Steve Jobs starts his autobiography, "I was sitting in a garage playing with computers," you know that that's going to go somewhere, because he's, you know, he's a billionaire writing a book about it. Sangharajta is not a billionaire, but obviously there's, you know, like, it is, something's happened. Yeah, so there's reading back into it. And that, of course, lends itself a bias. Like, obviously, it's very easy to tell things from, you know, again, you tell it from your side of the story, don't you? So you read things we tend to read things in a light which is favourable to us. And again, that, it's very hard not to do that, and whether you should even try not to. And the fact that we have the benefit of hindsight as well. So not only do we know that something important happened, but we also know kind of what that meant. Where, you know, when you make a decision, you know, you don't know where it's going to go, but then afterwards you can say, "Oh, right, well, that was a good decision because this came out of it." and that was a bad decision because that went badly wrong. But over time, you don't always know. Of course we don't. But it's just worth saying that before you tell any story. So that said, so Sangharakshita, 1964, shows up in London. He's 39 years old at this point. I'm sort of telling both his story and the story of Triratna. They get quite overlaid. And it's quite thematic. So he shows up in the UK, and basically he finds a relatively dry, boring and sleepy Buddhist world. There's not a lot going on and it's not very exciting. People at the time he went to this big 100 people Buddhist summer school, and 100 people, sort of everyone in the UK who's interested in Buddhism is at this summer school. It's the thing of the year. And he says, oh, why don't we teach some meditation? And everyone's like, oh, no, we don't do that. People have a view that meditation is dangerous. They're saying 5 minutes more than that will do things to people's minds. He's like, really? And he says, well, maybe I'll just have a little go. And he does some meditation, or he does some Buddhist ritual. And again, they're saying, nobody's going to like that. British Buddhist people like lectures. That's what they're interested in. And he stands up and says, well, I'm going to do a little bit of meditation, some Buddhist ritual tonight. Does anyone want to come? And 90% of the people come. And he's like, oh yeah, but they are interested, actually. But yeah, so broadly speaking, it's all a bit dry, boring and sleepy. And Sangharakshita develops this important friendship with a guy called Terry Delamere. And basically, you've got this thing where it's all a bit dry, boring and sleepy, and Sangharakshita's kind of rocking about. He's doing things which they don't quite like. It's very... The Buddhist establishment is very sort of middle class, and he's open to teaching anyone about Buddhism. He famously, this is really an example of significant backreading. He does an interview for Women's Hour on the radio, and we're 64, 65, 66, so the hippie movement is alive and well. It's hippies. And this interviewer says to him, if a hippie came to you and wanted to learn to meditate, what would you do? Hippies are bad and wrong, so they're kind of expecting some kind of well. And he says, well, I'll teach them to meditate. So he's quite open. He's quite open to exploring the scene. Basically, all of this results in him getting quite criticised by the establishment. And in fact, he decides to stay in the UK, and he goes back to India to say goodbye to his friends. And during that time, he gets a letter saying, don't bother coming back to the UK. We don't want you anymore. And he famously turns to his friend and says, do you know what this means? And his friend says, I know. And he says, it means a new Buddhist movement in the West. Which will be a classic example of one of these things where, if that fizzled and he went home again 2 years later, nobody would give a monkeys, because we're all here 50 years later. It's like, oh, da-da, that obviously means something. Yeah, so... Basically, it's the 1960s. Sangharakshita's in the UK. He's been in India for 40 years, 20 years. The UK's really changed the whole hippie movement and the growth of technology and all of that. And basically, he's just really up for experimenting. It's like, what's the possibility? Where's the energy? What can happen? And he gets quite heavily criticised by established Buddhism. For this, because he's not following the rules. He's an ordained monk at this point, and he doesn't follow all the rules, and we don't like it. And again, of course, they would see that differently. They would see, he was bad and wrong, and maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. So the sort of ways in which he didn't follow the rules. Well, for a start, monks traditionally are meant to be quite distant, so actually becoming friends with people, kind of engaging in their lives, is sort of not quite what's meant to be happening. So he's criticised for that. He has homosexual leanings, and people don't like that, and they're very suspicious, and they're like, and basically they start saying that he's doing, he's off doing naughty things with men. And in his opinion, he would say he wasn't, he was just friends with them. He's just kind of forming close, vivid friendships with people, but he got criticised for that. What else did he get criticised for? Probably some main things. Just being a bit radical. It's you know, you're kind of well into the swinging 60s, so you've just got a sense of possibility, of openness. And he gives it a go, so he like, he tries taking drugs to see what it's like. Is this, in a way, all the time he's asking, well, where's the energy? Is this, can you move towards enlightenment? Can you transform yourself and other people through this? And he kind of just checks things out. Broadly speaking, his conclusion about drugs is that they're overrated. His conclusion about drugs is that they are overrated. But yeah, sort of like in some ways, I don't know quite how to evoke this. Yeah, just this sort of open, radical thing. And it was an era when the East was very exciting and interesting. So people, there was a lot of energy and interest. And basically, he just started setting up this little Buddhist movement. And he ran meditation classes in the cellar of a bookstore in central London. And to give you a sense of scale, like the room would have been half the size of the room we're in tonight, and he would have been really happy if he had 12 people. He'd be like, wow, great, that's a good night. But one of the things he was doing straight from the start was he talked about the movement. He founded the Friends of Western Buddhist Order in 1967, so a couple of years after he'd been back. And he talked about the movement, you know, the movement. And this is quite puzzling because people are like, oh, right, the movement, okay. And then, you know, particularly people who kind of came in, so like people sitting where you know, like if I'm here and I'm talking about the movement, people are like, oh, yeah, great. And then people like, you're kind of like, you get a bit more interested. No, actually, I quite like this. What is this movement thing? The way people describe it is like they kind of lift up the curtain, they look behind, and there's absolutely nothing there. You know, he's telling a story. He's telling a story of a movement, but it's just him. You know, like, you know, if you think of this evening, like he would arrive on his Todd, he would get all the mats and cushions out, then teach people to, you know, make the tea, teach people to meditate. They'd all go home. Then he'd put the mats and cushions away, and then he'd do the washing up because it was just him. But he's talking about this movement. He's got a dream, and his. So what is the movement? What is this dream? In a sense, that's just a mystery. But it's sort of like, you know, his dream, the story he was telling was a sense of what the movement essentially for him was a bunch of people who actually wanted to practice Buddhism for its own sake. So he was very cautious about making it a formal society where people could pay a subscription and join. He was very cautious about making it academic. It's like what he was crucially trying to communicate was that, well, you know, meditation, Buddhism, the spiritual life, in whatever way you want to define it, is something that you do. However much you do it, it's up to you, but it's like you do it. It's not an abstract interest. You engage, you do it. You know, we as individuals, as much as we are interested in engage with practicing, hear those teachings, rather than it being some kind of like abstract kind of society thing. Amidst all of that, he's just kind of just having a go, basically. He's just having a go. And it's real, like he's really experimenting. So like a lot of his, you know, he gives a lot of lecture series where he's really just grappling with this question, well, what is this? You know, what is it to, you know, what is the significance of meditation for the Western world? What is the significance of Buddhism? I could give you, quite a lot of the things where, you know, what you've, is sort of your impression of what Buddhism is about, as much as it's informed by, well, coming here. There's some of the things which you'll just kind of completely take for granted, well, that's how it works. But actually those were quite radical innovations on his part. Like in a sense, probably the main thing is just the emphasis of people kind of engaging, kind of getting to know each other and that being valued and important. And like up until then, like most of the Buddhist world wouldn't really have seen that. That wouldn't have really been important. Like, you know, you think we like sit around and have cups of tea and it's like that's, in a sense, that's deliberate. We don't just do it because you don't just stop meditating, men stop being taught Buddhism. It's like we deliberately do that to kind of give people a chance to get to know each other, you know, to meet like-minded people, and that would not have been automatically assumed in the past. Yep, need to speed up. So amidst all of that, you have this kind of like this kind of crazy experimental period. And you just have, well, one of the most important things that happened to Sangharakshita, this guy, Terry Delamere, who was a very good friend to him. Like, Sangharakshita spent a lot of his life being quite lonely and quite isolated, is sort of, you know, separated from others through circumstance and through his own unusual personality. So Terry was his, well, one of his best friends, and he committed suicide about 1968 or something like that. Quite, you know, in a sense, quite tragically, he was like a very troubled human being. And Sangharakshita invested a lot of time and energy in sort of supporting him. And ultimately, you know, well, people make their own decision, don't they? But it adds a kind of poignancy, because this is a point where things are really taking off. He's like, Sangharakshita's running loads of classes and all of that. And he's also dealing with, you know, the death of his best friend, and talks about it in his memoirs, just saying, you know, like, you know, he's running around like a blue-ass fly, and he goes home every night and, you know, cries because his best friend's dead. It's just quite sad. Yep. So he carries on. We're now into the early 70s. He's kind of founded the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order as well. So he started ordaining people. And the first set of people he ordained, again, he just sort of started doing it. So, like, if you imagine, like, you lot, so you've been coming here, most of you, quite a few of you, you've been coming here for about a year. So after a year of he started teaching these classes, he did this thing where he started an order, and a bunch of people who showed up, he just ordained them, basically. He said, oh, you've been coming for a year, are you into this? And they're like, yeah, sort of. He's like, okay, I'm going to ordain you. And they're like, they didn't. They all were willing to do that, but they had basically no idea what that meant. One of them's still ordained, the rest of them just kind of died or floated off. And that kind of carries on for a while. He's kind of like, again, he's sort of like, he's got this vision, and he's trying to manifest it activating the people around him, or sort of like taking, people's interest and enthusiasm, he's sort of encouraging and supporting that. But quite often the vessels, their enthusiasm's too passing, and then they kind of just float off again. By about 1973, he has another generation of people come in. So the movement's been going about 5 or 6 years by this point. And basically, a load of hippies show up, and they're just really up for kind of just living, changing their lives. They're like, I have a life, I'll do this. And they engage very wholeheartedly. And these are the sorts of people who start having this experience where they're like, there's nothing, you know, you talk about the movement, but it's nothing here really, it's just you. And they actually want to help, and they start getting involved. And importantly, what he does at this point is he starts very, you know, almost from day one, he starts kind of giving people things to do. So he's like, right, I'm off to Cornwall for a year. You know, you lot teach Buddhism. It's very empowering, actually. It's a bit throwing people in at the deep end, but it was also a real sense of empowerment and this really important principle of like encouraging people to have a go and live it out in their own lives. Again, it results in a certain level of confusion and kind of messiness. So one guy describes like the first time he went to a meditation class, Sangharakshita was off in Cornwall by this time, and there were sort of like 4 or 5 people leading the class, and somebody asked him a question, and in fact the question was, Buddhism has something to say about ethics, doesn't it? So what does it have to say about ethics? And these 4 people have this kind of whispered conflict, they're like, what does it say about ethics? And they're like, it's like, oh yeah, there's the 5 precepts, and there's this, and this, and this, and this, we can't remember the 5th one, but it's something to do with blah, you know, like, yeah, just to evoke the level of like which they don't really know what they're doing, but they have a go, and people kind of love it, get into it. So it's like there's a real like hand, you know, recognising people's potential and kind of encouraging them to have a go. A guy called Subhuti, who's the second most influential person in the history of Triratna, he'd been ordained for about 3 months when Sangharakshita made him the chairman of the only Triratna Buddhist centre that existed, and charged him with this major building project to create what is today the London Buddhist Centre, which is our biggest European Buddhist centre. And like Subhuti was probably about, I don't know, like 25, 26 when he got given this job. So he's really going, Yeah, like really kind of like letting people have a go and saying go for it. Yep. So that's all the way through to the early 80s. Sangharakshita during this period is very, like, he's just alive. He's really kind of flowing with energy. And, yeah, the movement enters this quite interesting period of kind of like naive possibility. Like, people are just, they're so young and naive that they have loads of initiative, loads of possibility. And they just, they like, you know, like, they make so much stuff, but they make loads of really kind of like embarrassing mistakes as well. You know, when, like, they're basically, they're a bunch of kids, so they don't really know what they're doing, so they get very excited. And one of the things you have is you have quite extreme stuff. So you have people kind of going, yeah, free love. It's still, it's not that far from the end of the 60s. It's like, free love. Everyone starts having sex with each other. And then they're like, no, that's a really bad idea. Men and women should be completely separated. And they're kind of like pinging all over the place. Sangharakshita included to a certain extent, just kind of working out what to do. And some of that is quite messy, and people definitely get hurt, and yeah, and there's like, although I tell that in a slightly funny way, there's still, you know, this, our movement is still kind of resolving some of the issues from that time, particularly around Sangharakshita's own sexuality and how that went. And you could say a certain level of naivety he had about people's ability, people's individuality. So you've got this kind of charismatic man kind of exploring what it is to relate to other human beings, and part of that exploring sexuality, and people in some cases feeling that they weren't able to say no. That's not quite accurate, but sort of feeling that in hindsight, in some cases decades later, they're like, oh, actually, I wasn't totally into that. And it would seem that he was a bit naive about that. He thought that, you know, you're in this kind of open, free flowing environment. And people, if they're not into things, they just say it. And it would seem that people didn't always feel able to do that. Yeah, so that's, you know, yeah, one of the like more complex parts of our movement's history. Taking against a background of a period of, you know, like our society's general attitude to sex has, you know, really shifted over the last 40 years. So it's what in those days sort of seemed, I don't know, people just kind of messing around and having fun. These days, our society can be significantly more critical of that sort of stuff. And just, you know, like in people's own sexual inhibitions. So it's like, oh, you know, so it's like all this stuff about Sangharakshita having sex with people, and kind of like, oh, get that under the carpet because it's bad and wrong and we don't want anyone to know about it. Yep. So anyway, yeah, so we're entering we're in the mid-70s. And it's just a really close network of people kind of having a sense of possibility. And like it's still very small, so like the whole order is like 30 people who can kind of sit around in this room. So we've got this really close network, and people just throw themselves in. Like, people have dedicated their lives, you know, 40 years of their lives to kind of creating all these Buddhist centres and retreat centres and writing books and teaching people about Buddhism. And they just really threw themselves in. And Sangharakshita just kind of like supported their people's vision, people's desire to transform themselves. And as I say, some of that was at times significant levels of naivety, both about the scope of the influence and the speed with which they would transform society. You know, people saying, okay, yeah, like in 10 years... the UK will be 50% Buddhist, and then we'll move on to the States. And people kind of seriously thinking that's what they were going to do, because they're kind of, let's go. Doesn't quite work out like that, funnily enough. Yep. Then you have like the 80s and the 90s, and you've got this real period of growth, and with that again comes a certain arrogance, a certain sort of like triumphalism, a certain sort of like, we're the best and we know what's how it is. Yeah, and some of that's reflected, like, you have this, you know, like, it's like with companies, you have this period of like exponential growth, and that was like the 70s, 80s, 90s. You had a lot of exponential growth, and with that comes a certain sort of self-inflation. We come into the late 90s, early 2000s. I said this would be a quick story. Sangharakshita by now is getting into his 70s, And he's been sort of handing on for decades, but he starts really decisively saying, right, I'm getting old, you lot take over, you lot take charge. Particularly his most experienced disciples. And that's a funny transition, and in some ways that energy starts getting a bit, like energy's a bit blocked. It's sort of like it's a bit, you've had for growth, and then it gets a bit kind of fixed in a bit, a certain level of arrogance. When it gets a bit blocked, then we come on to the early 2000s, and basically by now Sangrachita is about 80, so he's kind of like he's reaching the point where he really isn't a significant factor in the Buddhist movement anymore. Like, you know, the majority of people have never met him, even the majority of order members don't really know him. There's the order by this point is like, I don't know, 1,200 people. So it's, you know, it's gone from, like, in the early 80s, in 1977, there were 30 people who were ordained and kind of committed to practicing Buddhism as part of their lives. By the early 2000s, you've got 1,200, 1,300 people. So it's completely changed, you know. Your capacity to have a sense of the people who you're doing this with has really shifted. And at this point, there's a real kind of, well, there's a period of chaos and pain, basically. All of his stuff, all of Sangrachita's health really nosedives. That coincides with, all the kind of like all the messy, complicated sex stuff from the 70s and 80s kind of re-emerges. And basically, you just have a bit of a meltdown where it all just goes a bit crazy and people are, people are just very lost in a sense. You've had Sangrachita as this real kind of like figurehead. And both his ability, his health in the present is diminished, and people are having questions about what's happened in the past, and it all just goes a bit all over the place. People just kind of lost, and all of that. You know, when you kind of like people are, in a sense, it's a natural maturation process where you're very inspired, you're young and you're inspired, you're like, let's go, and then you sort of hit middle age and you're like, I'm not sure. You know, this is, you can't carry on going in the same way. People are sort of like, hang on a sec, do I really want to be doing this? Sort of like, you know, you kind of like, have that kind of, is this really what I want? You know, didn't I want to kind of just play the guitar? So you have this whole splidge from about 2003 to 2008. Then in 2008... kind of something shifts, you know, like these 4 or 5 years of difficulty, kind of in a way what happens is a more kind of settled, like a more mature confidence starts re-emerging. People which is very much, you know, this is the most recent phase of the movement, so it's 2008 to the present day. Like there's it's hard to categorise. It's like a more mature, a more balanced confidence starts emerging. It's like the kind of that kind of naive, we can do it, we can change the world, we know best, has kind of died, which as it has to do, like for, you know, to use Jungian imagery, the naive male, the naive hero has died, and you've got a more mature, kind of balanced human perspective. It's like, okay, well, we've made some mistakes and we've done some good stuff and we've learned something and and let's move on from here. And it's characterised by, sort of like a more balanced confidence. There's also, what else happened? Sangrachita's health actually recovers a bit, and he in collaboration with Subhuti, publish a series of kind of important papers, sort of re-clarifying what the true Ratna Buddhist community is about in the first place. Because it's so big, so it's like, okay, well, what are the central points? And we change our name. We change our name to the True Ratna Buddhist Community from the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order to more accurately reflect the kind of the global nature of our movement. Western is increasingly an inaccurate term because you've got the movement in India and Latin America, and like the little shoots of it in Southeast Asia where Western doesn't mean anything. So now we enter. In a way, the current phase of the movement's history, which we're in, which, taking it back to Sangrachita a bit, is the sort of approaching death of a founder. So, in the people who've done studies of this in the history of new religious movements, the number which survived the death of the founder is fractional. You know, there's like the charismatic founder is often this completely crucial part of the puzzle, and once he dies, the whole thing sort of falls apart. Apparently, there's quite a lot of new religious movements. There's many more than you realise. So we're just like, in a way, we're just in the last this last couple of years. It's just Sangharakshita's. How old is he? He's 88. So and he's like, and his health isn't good. So it's like, okay, you know, so like increasingly, it's like, well, what's going to happen when he dies? And yeah, our movement's preparing for that. Like he's quite clear about it. Like he's living in the last place he's ever going to live. This place out in Hereford. He knows where his grave's going to be. He's just kind of like, in a sense, he's ready. And well, and everyone else. Well, our move. Like you could say he's spent the last 40 years getting ready for him to die. Like slowly. Kind of like passing on and empowering other people to practice Buddhism effectively and carry on in his absence. Yeah, and who knows what's going to happen.